two of our students are missing because they've become three this afternoon. Fuad called to say that Saba's given birth to a little girl. She's 3 kilos. And he said she's very nice. A summary of much of part one and a few sections from part two is to be found in the gleanings, section 13. If you wanted a series of extracts that would give the sense of part one of the first half of the Agon, you might turn to that compilation that Shoghi Effendi prepared. He says 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 passages that he's collected under the 13th heading in the gleanings. Now, among the themes that we were talking about last week is that of the divine test. On page 8 of the Agon, we read, from time immemorial, even unto eternity, the Almighty hath tried and will continue to try His servants, so that light may be distinguished from darkness, truth from falsehood, right from wrong, guidance from error, happiness from misery, and roses from thorns. Even as He hath revealed, do men think, when they say, we believe, they shall be let alone and not be put to proof? There are several other passages in this first part which give us the sense of what Baha'u'llah is trying to say. He says, were men to meditate upon the lives of the prophets of old, so easily would they come to know and understand the ways of these prophets, that they would cease to be veiled by such deeds and words, thank you, as are contrary to their own worldly desires. This is from page 53. And again, page 57. As thou comest to comprehend the essence of these divine mysteries, thou wilt grasp the purpose of God, the divine charmer, the best beloved. Thou wilt regard the words and the deeds of that Almighty Sovereign as one and the same, in such wise that whatsoever thou dost behold in His deeds, the same wilt thou find in His sayings. And whatsoever thou dost read in His sayings, thou wilt recognize in His deeds. Thus it is that outwardly such deeds and words are the fire of vengeance unto the wicked, and inwardly the waters of mercy unto the righteous. Were the eye of the heart to open, it would surely perceive that the words revealed from the heaven of the will of God are at one with and the same as the deeds that have emanated from the kingdom of divine power. Now, with regard to the words, he says on page 49, know verily that the purpose underlying all these symbolic terms and abstruse allusions which emanate from the revealers of God's holy cause hath been to test and prove the peoples of the world, that thereby the earth of the pure and illuminated hearts may be known from the perishable and barren soil. From time immemorial, such hath been the way of God amidst His creatures, and to this testify the records of the sacred books. And one of the examples of this test by means of words is the example of Noah that we read of last week. He several times promised victory to his companions and fixed the hour thereof, This caused a few among the small number of his followers to turn away from him. Then Baha'u'llah gives several examples of deeds or acts from God that have been also given as tests. He says, the appearance, this is page 72, the appearance of that immortal beauty in the image of mortal man with such human limitations as eating and drinking, poverty and riches, glory and abasement, sleeping and waking, and such other things as cast doubt in the minds of men and cause them to turn away. Again, he says, other prophets similarly have been subject to poverty and afflictions, to hunger, and to the ills and chances of the world. As these holy persons were subject to such needs and wants, the people were consequently lost in the wilds of misgivings and doubts, and were afflicted with bewilderment and perplexity. He gives some examples of things that happened also. This is one of the great veils. He talks about the clouds, the manifestation coming in clouds, and says that the clouds are these very, the very earthly frame that the manifestation appears in, a body like the rest of us have. And all this subjection to having to rest and eat and take care of himself that we have, apparently. Moses, he says, consider how, this is page 55, consider how he hath suddenly chosen from among his servants and entrusted with the exalted mission of divine guidance him who was known as guilty of homicide, who himself had acknowledged his cruelty, and who for well nigh 30 years had in the eyes of the world been reared in the home of Pharaoh and been nourished at his table. Was not God, the omnipotent king, able to withhold the hand of Moses from murder, so that manslaughter should not be attributed unto him, causing bewilderment and aversion among the people? Now you remember this incident of Moses coming to the help of another man and slaying someone who was attacking him. In the case of Jesus, he said, the case of Jesus, he cites the condition of Mary. He says, how could she claim that a babe whose father was unknown had been conceived of the Holy Ghost? And now meditate upon this most great convulsion, this grievous test. Notwithstanding all these things, God conferred upon that essence of the Spirit, who was known among the people as fatherless, the glory of prophethood, and made him his testimony unto all that are in heaven and on earth. Now, those of us that have been raised in Catholic tradition or in some of the Christian churches realize that Christianity glories in the fact that Christ was born of a virgin. But if such a thing happened down the street from us here, and this is not too far from Nazareth, and a young lady whose husband, they say, has never been with her, and she's now growing, her tummy is growing, and she's saying that the Holy Ghost has told me that this is from him for me. And what would the people in this neighborhood believe about that? You know? And then the child is born, and then this child, that is obviously no father, or we don't know who the father is. The father says he's not the father. This boy now says, I'm the son of God, and I've come to give you a message from God. This is only those people that have purity of heart and can see the Spirit in this thing are going to be able to pass such tests. He hasn't made it easy from that point of view. Now, what about Muhammad? He cites the example of the Qibla, the changing of the Qibla, the point of adoration. The voice of Gabriel was heard again. This is on page 50. The voice of Gabriel was heard again. This is Muhammad in the Quran. Turn thou thy face towards the sacred mosque. In the midst of that same prayer, Muhammad suddenly turned his face away from Jerusalem and turned toward the Kaaba. Now, Jerusalem had been the place that everyone addressed their prayers for centuries. You know? Even in Christianity, it didn't change. And the Jews continued to address their prayers towards it. Everyone had that as the natural point of reference, the holy city of Jerusalem. Now suddenly Muhammad, who is leading them in prayer there, he changes direction and faces someplace else, towards the center of the mosque, towards the Kaaba. Well, it's just the people that were in the middle of their prayers, you know, just happy to be going along with the traditions. He says that, whereupon a profound dismay seized suddenly the companions of the Prophet. Their faith was shaken severely. So great was their alarm that many of them, discontinuing their prayer, apostatized their faith. Verily, God caused not this turmoil, but to test and prove His servants. Otherwise, He, the ideal King, could easily have left the Qibla unchanged and could have caused Jerusalem to remain the point of adoration. Now, this took place, and the historical setting of it is that it took place because of the Jews. Some of them had pledged allegiance to Muhammad, and then they were known as the hypocrites in Medina. They had turned away afterwards, or they plotted against him. And this displeased God, so He said, let us change this Jerusalem, make another point of prayer. The Kaaba is a cube building in the center of the sacred mosque in Mecca. And that's the point around which circle the believers when they go on pilgrimage, the Muslim believers. You know, in Islam, at the beginning we heard that Baha'u'llah said the voice of Gabriel was heard again. Gabriel is the archangel considered in Islam as the mediator of revelation to Muhammad. And he's the personification of the divine spirit to him. If you look in God Passes By on page 100, you'll see a whole list of these various personifications of the Holy Spirit to the different prophets, like the burning bush to Moses and the sacred fire to Zoroaster, the dove to Christ, the angel Gabriel to Muhammad. What about Baha'u'llah? What was the symbol of the Holy Spirit to Baha'u'llah?
Maid of Heaven.
The Maid of Heaven that addressed him in the Siyat Chal. No, it was the Maid of Heaven. Mm-hmm. And what about the Bab? More difficult question. He had a dream. And what happened in the dream? Hossein. Yeah. Yes, he saw Hossein, the head of Hossein, hanging from a tree, and he went and he tasted of the blood that was dripping from it, and then that was transformed. That was the beginning of his prophetic mission. Which is very interesting because of the claim of Baha'u'llah to be the return of the Imam Hossein. The most great manifestation ever to appear in religious history claims to be the return of the third Imam of Muhammad. It's quite a distinction for the Imam Hussein. And his namesake, his name is Baha'u'llah's own name was Hussein Ali. Yes?
Can you give us some references as far as the appearance of Imam Hussein in the past?
About this dream?
Yes.
You can read about it in the Dawnbreakers, but I don't have the page number here. I believe it's in the footnotes, though, isn't it? I didn't know. Have you read it in a shorter Dawnbreakers or in the American, the long edition? Kent? It's also referenced in God Passes By, too. So there's a reference in God Passes By? Good. Now, on page 52 again, Baha'u'llah says, such things take place only that the souls of men may develop. and be delivered from the prison cage of self and desire. Inasmuch as the divine purpose hath decreed that the true should be known from the false and the sun from the shadow, he hath therefore in every season sent down upon mankind the showers of tests from his realm of glory. So this is one of these major themes that's discussed there. Well, have you been reading, continuing to read the text? I find that if we want to travel at the pace of ...50 pages a time, that really we're just skimming the surface. So if no one has to run off at the end of the course very soon, we might have that. Take something like 25 pages a class. It's a little more digestible portion. And then we'll see how far that takes us, probably into the end of June or something. There, we're going to go back a little bit because one of the major passages about the unity of the manifestations is on page 20 and 21. The bottom of page 20. We read that Baha'u'llah cites the reference from Christianity, from John 14. This is verse 28 and again verses 16 and 18 in the second verse. He says, "To them that are endowed with understanding, it is clear and manifest that when the fire of the love of Jesus consumed the veils of Jewish limitations, and his authority was made apparent and partially enforced, he, the revealer of the unseen beauty, addressing one day his disciples, referred unto his passing, and kindling in their hearts the fire of bereavement, said unto them, I go away and come again unto you. And in another place he said, I go and another will come, who will tell you all that I have not told you, and will fulfill all that I have said. Both these sayings have but one meaning, were you to ponder upon the manifestations of the unity of God with divine insight." Each of the manifestations manifests the unity of God, the oneness of God. Every discerning observer will recognize that in the dispensation of the Quran, both the book and the cause of Jesus were confirmed. As to the matter of names, Muhammad himself declared, "I am Jesus." He recognized the truth of the signs, prophecies, and words of Jesus and testified that they were all of God. In this sense, neither the person of Jesus nor his writings hath differed from that of Muhammad and of his holy book, inasmuch as both have championed the cause of God, uttered his praise, and revealed his commandments. Thus it's said that Jesus himself declared, "I go away and come again unto you." Consider the sun. Were it to say now, "I am the sun of yesterday," it would speak the truth. And should it, bearing the sequence of time in mind, claim to be other than that sun, it would speak the truth. It still would speak the truth. In like manner, if it be said that all the days are but one and the same, it is correct and true. And if it be said with respect to their particular names and designations, that they differ, that again is true. For though they are the same, yet one doth recognize in each a separate designation, a specific attribute, a particular character. Now the key, he says, conceive accordingly the distinction, variation, and unity characteristic of the various manifestations of holiness, that thou mayest comprehend the allusions made by the Creator of all names and attributes to the mysteries of distinction and unity, and discover the answer to thy question, this relates to one of the questions of the Bob's uncle, as to why that everlasting beauty should have at sundry times called himself by different names and titles. This is the on the sequential outline of the text, if you have that still with you. This was the section on distinction, variation, and unity of prophets. Do you have any comments or questions about that part at all? Anyone? All of this section, 49 to 59, pages 49 to 59, cover the purpose of symbolic terms and their that relations they have to testing and proving the people, that the sincere could be known from the false. In the course of the book, there are a number of passages which kind of stand out by themselves, where the narrative is interrupted and Baha'u'llah makes an appeal of the heart to the object of, kind of steps out of his regular narrative and appeals directly to the uncle of the Bab in different ways. One such passage is on page 22 and 23. And it also gives something of the explanation of this question of bread, divine bread. He says that this wrong one will cite but one of these instances, thus conferring upon mankind, for the sake of God, such bounties as are yet concealed within the treasury of the hidden and sacred tree, that haply mortal men may not remain deprived of their share of the immortal fruit and attain to a dewdrop of the waters of everlasting life, which from Baghdad, the abode of peace, are being vouchsafed unto all mankind. And this is one of the early references in the book to his own prophetic mission. See this allusion, he's saying that what's happening here, this treasury from the hidden and sacred tree and the share of the immortal fruit and a dewdrop of the waters of everlasting life being vouchsafed unto all mankind from Baghdad. You can cross-reference that to page 174 for this further references to this abode of peace, if I remember correctly. He said here, Baghdad, the abode of peace, the bottom of page 174, he said, and his word is the truth, and God calleth to the abode of peace, and he guideth whom he will into the right way. And again, for them is an abode of peace with their Lord, and he shall be their protector because of their works. Now, this is a prophecy from the Quran, which really tells the people where the manifestation of God will appear. The abode of a peace is Dar al-Salam, and Dar al-Salam is one of the names of traditional names of Baghdad. And he mentions here about this food. He says, we nourish your souls for the sake of God. We seek from you neither recompense nor thanks. This is the food that conferreth everlasting life upon the pure in heart and the illumined in spirit. This is the bread of which it is said, Lord, send down upon us thy bread from heaven. This bread shall never be withheld from them that deserve it, nor can it ever be exhausted. It groweth everlastingly from the tree of grace. It descendeth at all seasons from the heavens of justice and mercy. Down below he says, oh, the pity that man should deprive himself of this goodly gift, this imperishable bounty, this everlasting life. It behooveth him to prize this food that cometh from heaven, that perchance Through the wondrous favors of the Son of Truth, the dead may be brought to life and withered souls be quickened by the Infinite Spirit. Make haste, O my brother, that while there is yet time, our lips may taste of the immortal draught. For the breeze of life now blowing from the city of the Well-Beloved cannot last, and the streaming river of holy utterance must needs be stilled, and the portals of the Rizwan cannot forever remain open. The day will surely come when the nightingale of paradise will have winged its flight away from its earthly abode unto its heavenly nest. Then will its melody be heard no more, and the beauty of the rose cease to shine. Seize the time, therefore, ere the glory of the divine springtime hath spent itself, and the bird of eternity cease to warble its melody, that thy inner hearing may not be deprived of hearkening unto its call. This is my counsel unto thee and unto the beloved of God. Whosoever wisheth, let him turn aside thereunto, let him turn thereunto, and whosoever wisheth, let him turn away. God verily is independent of him and of that which he may see and witness. It's a very, again, very clear allusion to Baha'u'llah's own station here in this passage. It echoes the Persian hidden word, number 15, O Son of Spirit, the time cometh when the nightingale of holiness will no longer unfold the inner mysteries, and you will all be bereft of the celestial melody and of the voice from on high. So several different works Baha'u'llah alludes to this in this Baghdad period, even before his formal declaration. Please. I think it's not so much his passing, well, as the ephemeral nature of the manifestation is here now and is singing these things. Take advantage of it. He won't always be here. He doesn't say that he's going to die soon, but it is relatively soon when you think of the hundreds of years that the manifestation, the effect of his revelation is going to serve. He's really here just a brief time with us. 75 years that Baha'u'llah was on earth. Mm-hmm. This is my personal understanding. I think he's referring to his outer person. He disappears. That rose that is Baha'u'llah shining in the midst is going to go. It's not going to be there forever. And the melody that comes from his mouth is going to cease to come. I think that that's what it means, because we know the celestial melody doesn't stop. I mean, in the point of you still have the Word of God and you can receive it. But there's a special bounty, of course, in being able to recognize this coming from the manifestation of God. It has very, very particular mercies and things connected with it. If the soul should recognize the individual manifestation of God. You know, Baha'u'llah speaks about the proofs. He says that the first proof of the manifestation is his own self. First proof. Second is his revelation. And third are the words and meanings of that revelation. Tehnam. Well, and of course, when he's there, it means his person, but his person is shining with his other self, you know, with the divine self. Otherwise, what would be the difference between he and the rest of us, you know? So that's one sense. But I think the greatest proof of the manifestation is when a manifestation is there and he says, I'm the manifestation, or you see him, people don't need to hear anything. They see him and they catch a glimpse and they recognize. The pure in heart would know. Like Qudus saw the back of the Bab and knew that was the manifestation. He didn't need an explanation. That's one thing. Then the second, as I understand when he says revelation, is this power of revelation that he has to reveal verses. The state that the manifestation assumes as he chants the divine verses for the first time, reveals them. from the heaven, from the unseen heaven of concealment. He reveals them into the world. And in such moments, no one could hardly bear to be around him. Even his secretaries would swoon away. They keep. Now that power, he says, is the second proof. It's what I understand. And the third one is whatever the meaning of these verses, that's the one we're dealing with. The inspiration of these verses. We have that one left. But he's ordained that to be the greatest of all things in our time. You know? Also, we see the power of covenant manifesting itself in a special way. We see the growth of the cause, we see the suffering of the cause and the crisis and victory that takes place. These things are proofs for us too. We see the influence and effect of Baha'u'llah's spirit in our own being. And that, in a sense, is another proof. Those are not the only proofs, those are the greatest proofs. The one that is his person during his days, his person is the greatest proof, then his revelation, and then meanings of his revelation. Please.
Is there any particular reference in the writings? Why the manifestations of that is always come from this part of the world?
No, I don't know of any reference, and as far there are some other references that say that God hath never left people bereft of guidance. So he's given them guidance in one form or another, and in more primitive times we have the signs of prophets having appeared in the Western Hemisphere too, and among the Indian nations. But we don't have any of their names affirmed. We can assume, because God says he sent an apostle unto all his people, that there were some of them that were presumably divine messengers. We don't know which ones. But you see the influence of a great civilization arise, like in the Incan Empire of Peru, or some of the other, the Maya Quiche, which is based on a holy book called the Popol Vuh. Or Daganawida, one of the prophet of the five nations of the northeastern America, that brought five warring nations together and made them as one people. He used to preach and teach there around a fire. There are various stories of this sort, you know, you see that the founders are going the same direction. When you talk to the Quechuan Indians about the history of the prophets and things, they say, oh yes, that we had a teacher, Viracocha, who came, great. He was like the sun, they said. People thought they were sun worshippers because they worshipped the sun, but we worship the sun of truth. It's just, we understand what it means, but people don't understand in the past, and oftentimes have said that, you know, the Indians were so primitive that they worshipped the sun. They said that this man founded our nation, founded our culture, and gave certain laws. There's laws of honesty and truthfulness and things like that. And that he walked on the waters of Lake Titicaca. It's one of their traditions. So when the Christians say, oh, what, Christ walked on the water, they said, oh, well, maybe he's true then. They didn't expect that, you know, they think it's a unique miracle for all time. And then they had this tradition that in the future the manifestations, the messengers would come again to unite our people with all the people of the world. And they would have hair growing on their face, because they were Indians, they didn't have any hair growing on their face. And when Pizarro went, one of the Spanish conquerors went to South America, you recall the stories, their leaders, the Inca, welcomed him as if he were a god. He came sailing on this huge ship, sailing ship, and he had hair on his face. This was the tradition that they'd waited for, and they handed everything to them. And of course, they looted the whole nation and took all their gold and subjugated the people and everything. Now we see there's some other messengers that came with hair on their face also. This is an interesting connections in the Indian teachings. I remember in the Miskito language, the word Baha means he who is coming. In their dialect in Nicaragua. There are lots of traditions. The tradition of the Toba people, that they said that we were a spiritual people in the past. We lived in heaven. And there was a great tree which united heaven and earth. And we used to come down the tree to go to the hunting and fishing grounds. And then at night we would go back up the tree into our heavenly home. And one night, one day we came and went out, and the evil one, struck at the root of the tree and burned it or something, chopped it down, burned it. So when we came back, we found ourselves cut off, and we've been in exile ever since in this world, this terrible world here. Then you take a passage from Baha'u'llah's writing that says, we've come and we've planted the divine sapling in the world, and its branches shall reach unto heaven. And there's a passage in the Gleanings about this subject. So then we talk to them about the tree of life that the manifestation, the prophet of God plants. And the principles are these, the branches. And if you follow these branches, if you follow the principles, you'll live in heaven again. And they get all excited about it, of course. They find connecting ways to talk about these teachings and prophecies. So it's not that people have never been left completely without some indication of guidance, no? But they may have had to search for it. Now, the ways of the manifestations contrary to the desires of men. And then again, there's another one of these passages very similar here. Page 59. Great God, when the stream of utterance reached this stage, we beheld, and lo, the sweet savors of God were being wafted from the day spring of revelation. Another one of these passages where Baha'u'llah intimates to the uncle of the Bab what is happening in his own being and what the significance is of this treatise that he's writing. And the morning breeze was blowing out of the Sheba of the Eternal. Its tidings rejoiced anew the heart and imparted immeasurable gladness to the soul. It made all things new and brought unnumbered and inestimable gifts from the unknowable friend. The robe of human praise can never hope to match its noble stature, and its shining figure, the mantle of utterance, can never fit. Without word it unfoldeth the inner mysteries, and without speech it revealeth the secrets of the divine sayings. And so on. Instructeth them in the art of love's ways, and showeth them the secret of heart surrender. This is a beautiful passage, and the following one also, if you haven't read it, you'll want to look very carefully at. The universe is pregnant with these manifold bounties, awaiting the hour when the effects of its unseen gifts will be made manifest in this world. And this is, I think, has not only meaning for Baha'u'llah's declaration, the beginning of his mission, but also for this whole process of the appearance of Baha'u'llah's revelation in the world. It's come and he's left it, but now it's working out through the consciousness of men and beginning to crystallize into a new way of viewing things, into the possibilities of the coming together and coming of age of the entire human race. And it's this question, the degree to which we Baha'is in teaching the cause allow this spirit, this confirmation that we have in being believers, to permeate the consciousness of other people. Even at first they don't become Baha'is, but yet they agree with the direction the faith is going, with what it stands for. Until this begins to suffuse the masses. And then we'll see very radical changes, like springtime. At first, in the early spring, there's just a few choice flowers that come up ahead of all the rest. But gradually, as the season becomes solidly set and the general warmth of the atmosphere increases, then you have whole hillsides and full meadows suddenly come to bloom. Entry by troops. But it depends on the change in the climate of the world. In its beginning, we're at the very beginnings of it now, but this is nothing like how it will develop later on. In our lifetimes too, yes.
Doesn't matter if we teach him, he doesn't become Baha'i. By the way, just we have been changing climate.
It has a definite effect. If we don't teach because we say, well, these people aren't receptive and they're not becoming Baha'is, our responsibility is to teach. Our responsibility is not that they accept the faith. That's not our responsibility. That's their responsibility. But ours is to do our best to portray the faith, to give the faith in the right spirit. And then we leave them in the hands of God. If they respond, fine. If they don't, he says, pray for them. Don't bawl them out and, you know, say, what's the matter with you? I wasted my time. I could have been teaching 50 people I taught you and you didn't even listen to me. No, let me just say, smile and pray for them and go away. Sometimes, believe me, in a Baha'i teaching situation, you want to tell the people, look, how shall I get through to you? But there's a time for everything. And you have to find what you can say that will float, what you can say that won't be heavy on the hearts of the people. That's important too in the teaching work. In some of Abdu'l Baha's talks in America, he didn't come to the point of Baha'u'llah's appearance. It was enough Abdu'l Baha's presence there. And then he would speak generally of harmony among people and unity of mankind and the oneness of religions and the prophets. And just let that settle on them. Kind of prepare them. Occasionally he'd find an audience that was receptive and he'd go on to say that 2,000 years ago Christ appeared on the horizon of the world and shed his radiance upon everything. And in the last century, Baha'u'llah appeared and likewise cast his radiance upon everything. Okay, if you want to make the connection, you can make the connection. You can say he's saying that Baha'u'llah is the return of that same light that Christ brought. But he veiled it. He said, in no wise should the veil be rent asunder too suddenly. When you get a receptive soul, you can move forward and you can say everything. But you don't want to strike people dead with the truth. Powerful. It's powerful. Maybe you've been in a teaching situation where you've said too much too soon and you see that people wilt. It's just like too much sunlight on the poor little flower and it just comes. This is too much for me, I think. Maybe they'll get refreshed in another season or something, but you feel like, what did I do now? Huh? Couldn't I have been a little quieter? Couldn't I have stopped a little sooner? Now, if you say, well, my Baha'i teacher said you have to say the whole explanation. And you never know who's going to be receptive, so you have to give the message. This is true, but you don't have to give the whole message. You give a little and see if they're receptive to that. And then give a little more and see if they're receptive to that. And then move forward. It's a great psychology in teaching to listening. This is the way you find out also what the people, where they are, what they're doing. It's always better to start by listening to people and remembering that you're the Baha'i message in your person. Your presence there, being a Baha'i, with the intention of sharing the message of Baha'u'llah, you're already shining with something that makes you different. And the people want to talk to you because you're different. And sometimes, and Shoghi Effendi said, this is the best teaching situation. They ask you, why is it you're different from the other people? Great opening question for teaching the faith. different from other people. The worst of all scenarios is that you tell them about the faith and they say, yeah, but what difference has it made in your life? Well, I'll go home and start again with my prayer book. Again, he appeals to him on page 61. Therefore, O brother, kindle with the oil of wisdom the lamp of the Spirit within the innermost chamber of thy heart, and guard it with the globe of understanding, that the breath of the infidel may extinguish not its flame nor dim its brightness. Thus have we illuminated the heavens of utterance with the splendors of the Sun of divine wisdom and understanding, that thy heart may find peace, and that thou mayest be of those who, on the wings of certitude, have soared under the heaven of the love of their Lord, the All-Merciful. Now, I'm not going into all the ins and outs of this verse from Matthew. You need to read these things, all the various significances. One of the signs of the coming of the manifestation of God are that there is a sign in the visible heaven and in the invisible heaven, Baha'u'llah says. The signs in the visible heaven are the stars that appear before the appearance of each manifestation. And there's some traditions about that in the different religions and so on. You'll find this references to this between pages 61 and 66. And as to the invisible heaven, he's talking about those spiritual leaders of men, the heralds of the manifestation that come and announce their coming. Yes?
On page 63, what does it mean when it's referring to the Salsabil of divine wisdom?
The Salsabil of divine wisdom. Salsabil is a river or a fountain of paradise in the Islamic traditions. So it's like saying a divine fountain or a fountain of divine wisdom. Let's see if I have a reference to it here. Source reference.
There's usually a glossary in the back of the edition. It's names below.
Mm-hmm. Kosar is another one. The Kothar or Kosar is a river in paradise likewise. You have the Salsabil in the back, the name of a heavenly river or wellspring in paradise. It implies easy, sweet, soft flowing water. See Quran 76:18 for the mention of it in the Quran. It's also first mentioned here on page 54. Yes. Why does Baha'u'llah say that? At the bottom of 63, otherwise this servant regardeth the consideration of such records a grave mistake and a grievous transgression. Go up the page a little bit. He's talking about the appearance. Moses came. After him came Moses, who held converse with God, and the soothsayers of his time warned Pharaoh in these terms: a star hath risen in the heaven, and lo, it foreshadoweth the conception of a child who holdeth your fate and the fate of your people in his hand. In like manner there appeared a sage who in the darkness of the night brought tidings of joy unto the people of Israel, imparting consolation to their souls and assurance to their hearts. To this testify the records of the sacred books. Were the details to be mentioned, this epistle would swell into a book. Moreover, it is not our wish to relate the stories of the days that are past. God is our witness that what we even now mention is due solely to our tender affection for thee, that haply the poor of the earth may attain the shores of the sea of wealth, the ignorant be led unto the ocean of divine knowledge, and they that thirst for understanding partake of the salsabil of divine wisdom. Otherwise, this servant regardeth the consideration of such records a grave mistake and a grievous transgression. Baha'u'llah is the source of infinite divine revelation. Why should he report the sayings of men to bring the proof of the mission of the prophets? But as they're wedded to these things, he's brought them. Otherwise, he says, I don't want to make reference to the past. This is the day to proclaim the divinity of the manifestation of God and to establish his kingdom in the world. I think that's the sense of... There's a couple other places where there are a few lines like that. He goes back again. He says, in like manner, and then he talks about the Magi that came to look for Jesus. Do you remember the Magi are said to be three Zoroastrian priests, the three wise men that we hear about in Christianity coming. And there are prophecies in the Zoroastrian traditions that told them that when a star appears in the west, you follow it and you'll find the promised one. So they did that, according to their prophecy. So this is why they came. You know, you wonder, well, where did these wise men come from? Why have they come out of the east on their camels looking for Christ? Because they saw the star. Well, how do they know the star meant anything? Because their traditions told them that this was so.
That's not ever mentioned in the Bible.
No.
Never told.
But the Zoroastrians have it in their books. And Magi are the priests or the holy ones of the Zoroastrian faith. Interesting. Yes, I think there are some. You can find the references to the titles that are in the Zoroastrian books for Baha'u'llah in chapter 5 of God Passes By. Here we have reference also to Sayyid Kazim, Sheikh Ahmad and Sayyid Kazim on page 65. Now concerning this wondrous and most exalted cause, know thou verily that many an astronomer hath announced the appearance of its star in the visible heaven. Likewise there appeared on earth Ahmad and Qasim, those twin resplendent lights, may God sanctify their resting place. From a book called Our First Century, cited by William Sears in Thief in the Night, there's an explanation that in 1843, just prior to the declaration of the Bab, a great comet suddenly appeared in the heavens. The comet of 1843 is regarded as perhaps the most marvelous of the present age, having been observed in the daytime, even before it was visible at night. Passing very near the sun, exhibiting an enormous length of tail, and arousing interest in the mind, in the public mind, as universal and deep as it was unprecedented. Now, there's some other explanations of this. They say that this is like Halley's Comet that was coming across the sky, that had a burning front part and then a smaller light towards the back. And as it was coming, gradually the front part dimmed and the latter part became brighter than ever the first part had become. It was like a twin star comet that was noted. There's several accounts of this kind of thing and the influence that it had, and that was a period of great millennial spirit anyway, where people were going out on mountaintops waiting for Christ to appear in the heavens and so on, especially in North America. Yes, we don't know which was. You know, we know that that took place. This is an account that there were comets, there were special stars, they were brighter than anything people had seen. There was the great ball of stars in the 1830s, showers of stars, because, you know, the stars would fall from heaven at the time of the coming that some people said was a sign of literal coming of Christ. But Baha'u'llah and Abdu'l-Bahá don't connect the precise star. Baha'u'llah says, all he says here is this affirmation that we have here, that many an astronomer hath announced the appearance of its star, that of the Bab's coming in the visible heaven. This would still be the Bab, because this is Baha'u'llah's defense of the cause of the Bab. He hasn't yet declared his own mission when he wrote the Igan. Although, as you see this evening, he's alluding to it all the time, here and there. It's coming, and that his voice is the voice of this nightingale, and his presence is to be sought, so to speak. Yes. Well, here he's saying it's a star every time, or a light in the heavens, a star, a comet, or something like that.
Like, for example, in the Bible, the falling of the stars. There was, I think, I read somewhere there was Gideon after falling of the stars. It happened in, I think, in Adrianople or something.
Mm-hmm. Meteorites and things.
And it has a spiritual and significant point. And like the darkening of the moon into blood or something. And then it's going to have a meaning in the life. Or
yes, some of them may be fulfilled in some literal way out in the heavens, but then also we know that sun and moon have other meanings, like laws and that have been eclipsed, and the people have stopped following them. And all the various meanings that he gives here for sun and moon. Pages 33 to 43. So it doesn't always, you know, refer to something in the outer heavens. Yes.
This physical and take this into consideration. Do we have to pray to people that this is something genuine, or we just, you know, because it confuses me, like we might end up teaching like the Christians, whereby they look into a desk and then they say, this would favor the, you know, the street, the way they want to speak. And then they say, this is a real thing, and then when he doesn't, and then they say, this was a spiritual,
you know, meaning, yeah, yes.
I think, to me, I feel like,
well, it may not be a powerful proof to the people that you're teaching. On the other hand, there may be Baha'is who will be interested in, it will be a confirmation to them if they hear these things after they've accepted the faith. So it certainly has its usefulness. Whether you use it in all your teaching situation, that's the wisdom that you have to develop as a teacher. There's nothing that says you have to use that every time you talk about this subject. You can choose what is in accordance with the mentality of your listeners. I think some audiences, this kind of thing is very interesting to them. I remember when I was teaching in Nicaragua, it was not long that the Sputnik was up in the air, you know, the first satellites were going around. And I had heard about this satellite, and I was off in the forest. I came north with a small little putt-putt boat up to a remote lagoon and was in an Indian village, and I've been proclaiming the faith. They're talking to them about the faith, and was staying in that village that night. Well, the whole village had gathered on the beach, and I was making, I don't know what kind of designs in the sand, something to teach them by making drawings in the sand with a stick. They were all looking and watching, and they were hearing this thing. Then I said also that that it was interesting, you know, that the advancements of the people, that there was this satellite which was, that man had put up in the air, like a star was traveling. And that it was actually was coming tonight. And I wanted to see it, and it would be coming. They could look at it. This was bad business. I shouldn't have mentioned some of the stuff. Because people sat up for a long time. I sat up for a long time. And that was like, you know, the prophecy unfulfilled. It was a clear sign to the people that this message was something from the devil and not to be followed. So finally, with a kind of heavy heart, I went to bed and found some bench where I was supposed to sleep and fell asleep. The breeze is blowing in the palm trees, you know, and the moonlight is shining its beams of moonlight in the village, and there's this kind of celestial silence, and the cockroaches fall out of the ceiling onto your stomach while you're trying to sleep. And the tarantulas crawl across your pillow and you feel this strange hairy thing. And there's no light to turn on, you just have to get rid of it. I remember I got it, I was put in a room sleeping on a little bench all by myself, and thought, "What's this? How can the people give me this whole room just for me?" And in the night I felt this hairy thing fall on my foot and flicked it off of my foot onto the floor. And when it hit the floor, instead of hitting the floor, you know, and sounding like a spider hitting the floor, bodies started rolling all around. I realized that after I'd gone to sleep, everybody'd come in and they were all sleeping on the floor of the same room that I was in. When I wake up in the morning, they're all gone and I'm in my private room again, you know. Anyway, this particular night, the call was raised about 1 in the morning. Look! Look! The Baha'i star, come! So the whole village got up to look at the Baha'i star. Sure enough, it was going across there. So we had another good meeting the next day. It was all right. Oh, my. So sometimes it's important to mention stars we made, but it's a gamble, you see. They were so insistent that Christ was going to come in the clouds that he had to see him in the clouds and then they'd believe. And then I read about that time Time magazine came out with an article that the U.S. Marine Corps had developed, or the Navy or something, had developed these tanks that you put on your back, you know, and you turn them on and they would take you up in the air about 30, 40 feet and you could go through the air about the length of a football stadium up high. And I was just thinking, if I could only get somebody to send me one of these on the stage. I'd go up there and hold up a sheet. Baha'i is true, you know. It was a little hard to get through to the people in those early stages. Oh, my. Really, these remote areas, some of the people were so fixed. You know how that is in your own country. I bet in Botswana it's like that, too. Some areas, they're so fixed in biblical, their understanding of biblical truths. They were always preaching in the church there that the devil is about 6 foot tall and he has blonde hair. I had more blonde hair then than I do now. I hear the people saying that. Didn't you hear that? The devil is tall, very tall, and he has blonde hair. This one village we taught was a remote area, and they weren't very deepened in Christianity or anything. They'd been Anglicans. And they all became Baha'is on a visit of Dr. Mahajir in the area, and I'd gone and taught this village. They'd all come into the village. All right, that was good. We went back again. Then the priest had been through and was passing these rumors out. So we had a nice Baha'i meeting, and sang some Baha'i songs, said prayers, and everybody was happy. And then Mr. Carlos, old Mr. Carlos, raised his hand. He said, just one question I have. I said, yes. He said, the priest came and he said that you're the devil self. You're the devil himself, in other words. You're the devil self. He said, I just want to know if it's true or not. He said, I'm still with the Baha'i, but I want to know. Oh, my goodness. Judge for yourself. No, they found out later that I was surfing in canoes among the sharks, and they thought that was quite an extraordinary accomplishment. It made me a local folk hero. I didn't have any idea that was going to happen. I was just trying to get ashore from where we'd been, where we'd been with this canoe. But if you want an interesting experience, go pioneering in the bush someplace. That's great stuff. How did we get off the subject of the John here? Stars in the heavens. Sixty-nine. Here's an interesting subject. First, the page before is absolutely fascinating. Two pages before, all about heavens and different kinds of heavens and the significance of it. And I'm sure I don't know how to explain it to you, but it's fascinating, and you should read it with great interest. Wert thou to cleanse the mirror of thy heart, this is page 68, from the dust of malice, thou wouldst apprehend the meaning of the symbolic terms revealed by the all-embracing word of God made manifest in every dispensation, and wouldst discover the mysteries of divine knowledge. Not, however, until thou consumest with the flame of utter detachment those veils of idle learning that are current amongst men, canst thou behold the resplendent morn of true knowledge. Know verily that knowledge is of two kinds, divine and satanic. The one welleth out from the fountain of divine inspiration, the other is but a reflection of vain and obscure thoughts. Do you remember on page 46 we read that knowledge is a light last week, which God casteth into the heart of whomsoever he willeth? It's a very different kind of definition of knowledge from the one we think of so much as much information gathered, so to speak. Now, here he's saying that the one welleth out from the fountain of divine inspiration. This fountain is in the heart of each of us. The other is but a reflection of vain and obscure thoughts. The source of the former is God himself, the motive force of the latter, the whisperings of selfish desire. The one is guided by the principle, fear ye God, God will teach you. The other is but a confirmation of the truth. Knowledge is the most grievous veil between man and his creator. The former bringeth forth the fruit of patience, of longing desire, of true understanding and love, whilst the latter can yield naught but arrogance, vainglory, and conceit. From the sayings of those masters of holy utterance, who have expounded the meaning of true knowledge, the odor of these dark teachings which have obscured the world can in no wise be detected. The tree of such teachings can yield no result except iniquity and rebellion, and beareth no fruit but hatred and envy. Its fruit is deadly poison, its shadow a consuming fire. How well hath it been said, cling unto the robe of the desire of thy heart, and put thou away all shame. Bid the worldly wise be gone, however great their name. Yes?
Concerning the second kind of knowledge that's talked about there, religious bigotry and prejudice and superstition, rather than general secular education.
I don't think so, surely. Not so surely. I think it centers on that, but I think any knowledge that you with which you pride yourself in opposition to God is this kind of knowledge. Any knowledge which veils you from recognizing the truth. And you may be a Nobel Prize winning physicist. Who knows? It's the way you hold knowledge. Now, first of all, we're told in the faith, detach ourselves from all things. Take no pride in your learning. Okay, if you can remove that and humbly approach the truth, and accept Baha'u'llah, then you readjust everything that you do to what he has asked of you. And one of the things he asks of you is to study all the arts and sciences, to become expert in whatever you deal with. But then you're doing it for him. There's a different motive than the one they talk about here, arrogance, vainglory, and conceit. You know? But no doubt it has a lot to do with this so-called religious doctrine and so on. But I think it applies in these other realms too, because you see people who are veiled by their materialistic view of life, by their agnostic liberal position, so to speak, almost taking pride that they don't believe in God, you know? That, well, they recognize that there are people that have a need for that kind of thing. But they are not so so poor that they have to. They don't have need of such crutches, you know. If you need God for a crutch, well, you can. This is a very subtle kind of thing. Did you want to ask something? Please.
Isn't it true that Darwin said that knowledge, all knowledge is from God? So even the knowledge that you acquire through, you know, learning and studying, it originally comes through the influence of divine.
Yes, I think in a sense, but it gets misused. But all knowledge comes from God, I think, means all true knowledge. But these vain, reflected thoughts, the kind of knowledge that one employs for seeking sensual pursuits or something like that, it's not that kind of knowledge. I mean, all right, God has given the mind to man, but he says he should keep his mind cleansed and shouldn't have impure thoughts. Are these impure thoughts knowledge from God? I don't think we can say that. They are the result of a distortion of the use of the human mind and of thoughts, because it's wedded to worldly interests, to bodily desires and so on. So this seems that there's some distinction there. And then here he's telling us also there's two kinds of knowledge. So the true knowledge, yes, is from one, from God, but he is knowledge, he is truth in that sense. But there's all these vain imaginings and idle fancies, as he calls them in the prayers, that, you know, that we see all the time, that seem to possess us from time to time as well. Page 69, this if you want to take note, if you're taking these kinds of notes, the bottom of page 69, that poem is from Ibn Fariz of Egypt. And the other one, He That Treadeth the Snow White Path, is from Mohyeddin Gilani. Rather obscure sources for the West, so Shoghi Effendi hasn't footnoted them. In defense of what also some of what Ayman was saying, that this passage in knowledge clearly extols that knowledge which is divine in origin and condemns that which arises from the self of man. Human learning can act as a terrible veil blinding the soul to its purpose in life and its ultimate destiny. Useful knowledge acquired in conformity with the bidding of the prophets of God is, however, most praiseworthy, as Baha'u'llah indicates. Arts, this is a quote, arts, crafts, and sciences uplift the world of being and are conducive to its life. I think it is. There's a word missing in the manuscript. I'm so sorry to find that. Knowledge is as wings to man's life and a ladder for his ascent. So this is the other side of knowledge in the good sense of it. Its acquisition is incumbent upon everyone. In truth, knowledge is a veritable treasure for man and a source of glory, of bounty, of joy, of exaltation, of cheer and gladness unto him. Happy the man that cleaveth unto it, and woe betide the heedless. While Baha'u'llah extols the study of sciences and arts, he directs men to such sciences as are useful and would redound to the progress and advancement of the people. The point to bear in mind with regard to the acquisition of knowledge and education is that it must not be allowed to become a barrier between oneself and God. Abdu'l-Bahá emphasizes this truth as follows. quote, "Although to acquire the sciences and arts is the greatest glory of mankind, this is so only on condition that man's river flow into the mighty sea and draw from God's ancient source his inspiration. When this cometh to pass, then every teacher is as a shoreless ocean, every pupil a prodigal fountain of knowledge. If then the pursuit of knowledge lead to the beauty of him who is the object of all knowledge, how excellent that goal. But if not, a mere drop will perhaps shut a man off from flooding grace. For with learning cometh arrogance and pride, and it bringeth on error and indifference to God. The sciences of this world are droplets of reality. If then they lead not to reality, what fruit can come of illusion? By the one true God, if learning be not a means of access to him, the most manifest, it is nothing but evident loss. It is incumbent upon thee to acquire the various branches of knowledge and to turn thy face toward the beauty of the manifest beauty, that thou mayest be a sign of saving guidance amongst the peoples of the world and a focal center of understanding in this sphere from which the wise and their wisdom are shut out, except for whoso setteth foot in the kingdom of lights and becometh informed of the veiled and hidden mystery, the well-guarded, secret well-guarded." This is from the Baha'i Education compilation, this quotation from the Master, page 13. This saying, "Knowledge is a grievous, is the most grievous veil between man and his creator," is a traditional Sufi saying. Sufi being one of the mystic school of Islam. The quote that I read for you earlier is here too, that one should recognize the manifestation, recognize him only by his own self. And that was from Gleanings, page 105. He says, "The first and foremost testimony establishing his truth is his own self. Next to this testimony is his revelation. For whoso faileth to recognize either the one or the other, he hath established the words he hath revealed as proof of his reality and truth." So that's the exact quote on that. And again in Gleanings, page 49, he says, "He who is everlastingly hidden from the eyes of men can never be known except through his manifestation. And his manifestation can adduce no greater proof of the truth of his mission than the proof of his own person." It's page 49 of Gleanings. Okay. Please.